The new series is called What is Armageddon? As Elder Larry said, it's five parts, but I'm thinking of making it six. So pray for me. It's really neat. In 1212, a French shepherd boy by the name of Stephen claimed that Jesus had appeared to him disguised as a pilgrim. Supposedly, Jesus instructed him to take a letter to the King of France, who at that time was in the Holy Lands. Before long, he had gathered a large following of more than 30,000 children who accompanied him on his pilgrimage. And when he arrived at the city of Marseilles, and discovered that the waves did not part and they could not go through dry shod as they expected, they came to a startling halt. But there were present there in Marseilles two men, Hugo Faresus and William Porcus. The men claimed to be so impressed with the calling of the children that they offered to transport them across the Mediterranean in seven ships without charge. What the children didn't know was the two men were slave traders. The children boarded the ship and their journey began, but instead of setting for the Holy Land, they settled straight across to North Africa, where they were sold as slaves in a Muslim market that did a large business in buying and selling human beings. Few, if any, returned. None ever reached the Holy Land because two cunning men enjoyed enormous financial profit simply because they were willing to deceive the lives of these children. My friends, we are living in the age of deception. And I hope it will be more clear to you as we move through this series. Now, about 500 years ago, 31st of October, 1517, was when Martin Luther nailed the thesis, his 95 theses, to the wall, to the door in his church, as well as sent a copy to the Archbishop Albert of Brandenburg. And I'm telling you, when you read history, it's amazing. But in the mind of Luther, he was just making an academic oration to start a debate because he was so upset with the way he saw things going in the church. Little did he know what was going to transpire by this simple act of initiating discussion. So let me give you a little bit of history to set the stage for this very moment 500 years ago, October 1517. I'm going to run through this quickly so you can see. At the time Martin Luther nailed the thesis to the church door, here's what had transpired prior to that event. The fourth pope, Pope Clement, considered himself to be the first apostolic father. Pope Calixtus established that he could absolve sins. The next pope on my list is the 37th pope, Pope Damasus. And he was the first to claim the apostolic see rested solely on Peter. His position was directly ordained through Peter. And then Pope Siricius was the first pope to call himself, first pope to call himself pope. Let me explain that. Technically, Pope Clement and all those others were bishop of Rome. But when this pope came into to the office, he declared himself the papa of everybody, the pope. And then came Pope Innocent I, and he declared the primacy of jurisdiction. That means not only is the pope over all the religion, but he's also over the politics also. Pope Leo the Great took the title Pontificus Maximus, chief priest. Then Gelasius was the first to take the title Vicar of Christ. And then Pope Gregory the Great came up with purgatory and the Augustinian idea that there are such thing as just wars. By the way, the predecessor of persecution. Pope Gregory the VII declared the priest must be celibate, and he's the pope that made Henry the IV standing barefoot in the snow at Kenosis for 3 days before he forgave him. Pope Innocent III represented the zenith of papal power. And using Jeremiah 1:10, the Pope declared that he stands between God and man as mediator as well as vicar of Christ. Pope Boniface VI was extreme and extravagant. He is the one with imperial robes, rich jewels, and he said, "I am Caesar, I am emperor." And Boniface the VI in the 13th century up to this point made those claims. The Pope now had supreme power at this point when Martin Luther nailed that thesis to the wall. But there's something else that took place also prior to him nailing it to the wall. The church in the 13th century had almost completely wiped out the Albigensians in southern France because they didn't agree with the Catholic doctrine and the things that were happening. Peter Waldo and his group, the Poor of Lyon, were declared heretics by the Catholic Church in the 12th century, and their persecution began and went on till they almost annihilated the Waldensians. Meantime, in England, Wycliffe was accorded the Morning Star of the English Reformation, wrote the New Testament in the vernacular. In December 1384, he suffered a stroke and died as the year ended. But in May 1415, almost 30 years later, the Pope declared him a heretic. They dug up his bones and they burned them and threw the ashes on the River Swift and then proceeded to persecute the Lollards, who were the followers of Wycliffe. Tyndale completed the work of the Bible in the vernacular, and they strangled him, and his body was burned at the stake. A short while later, Huss and Jerome were burned at the stake, and the Hussites began to be persecuted in Czechoslovakia. And so you see, when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the church, here's what history states. At the commencement of the 16th century, Europe reposed in a deep sleep of spiritual death. There was none that moved a wing or opened a mouth or a peep against the Pope. And so little did Luther know when he pounded the 95 Theses on the door that it set off a furor. But I also want you to know this. That Eberhard II, Archbishop of Salisbury in 1240, called the Pope the Antichrist. John Wycliffe, 40 years later, called the Pope Antichrist. Martin Luther, at that time, called the Pope Antichrist. Cotton Mather, a Congregationalist theologian, called the Pope Antichrist. John Wesley, a Methodist, called the Pope an Antichrist. Ellen G. White of the Seventh-day Adventist called the Pope the man of sin or Antichrist. Thomas Cranmer, an Anglican, called the Pope the Antichrist. Roger William, first Baptist pastor in America, called the Pope Antichrist. The London Baptist Confession declared the same thing. John Knox, a Scottish Presbyterian, called the Pope the Antichrist. John Calvin, another Presbyterian, called the Pope the Antichrist. Charles Spurgeon of England called the Pope Antichrist. Philip Melanchthon, the brilliant theologian that worked side by side with Luther, called the Pope the Antichrist. Sir Isaac Newton called the Pope Antichrist. Incredible. In fact, it is declared in some of the history books that I looked at that were written back then that all the Protestant preachers and all the Protestant churches agreed on this issue. So when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door, it set off a fire that just raged like the fires up in Utah right now, until it almost consumed everything. And you see, the reformers, all of these men, clearly saw Daniel 7, the little horn, was Antichrist, the Pope. They clearly saw that Revelation 13, we call it the sea beast, was the Antichrist, which was the Pope. 2 Thessalonians 2, Antichrist, Pope. All of them agreed based on the scriptures in their study. But I want you to see what took place that is so historically incredible and must be shared before we look at the topic of Armageddon. And that is, the papacy was now reeling with all of the attacks upon her. The Pope's noose, if you would allow, was in his neck, was in the noose. And so the Council of Trent in 1545 was called in order to figure out what to do about the massive bleeding that was occurring to the church because of the understanding of Bible prophecy from all of these godly men. By the way, many of these men that I read off to you were formerly Catholic priests. And 27 years later, a Jesuit priest called Ribera, Francisco Ribera, wrote a book in which he claimed, and it was published in 1590, he claimed that in the book of Revelation, it's all in the future. It hasn't happened yet. Okay? It's all in the future. Hasn't happened yet. Now, you understand the noose is suddenly removed from the papacy. Except the Protestants didn't accept that. But in 1811, a man named Manuel de Lacunza, another Catholic Jesuit priest, wrote another book about the second coming of Jesus Christ. And he wanted to make sure that his Protestant brothers would read the book. And so what he did was use an assumed name of a Jewish author and wrote the book. And Edward Irving in 1827 read that book, translated it into English, and disseminated it from Scotland, and teaching the futurist view of prophecy. And then John Darby in the 19th century added to it. And by the way, John Darby was a Protestant pastor of a Pentecostal church. He heard from Irving about this book of Lacunza's that parroted what Ribera wrote in order to get the Pope's neck out of the noose, that made up a theology that the Bible teaches that Revelation is all in the future, and John Darby then added the rapture to it in the 19th century. The rapture was not known until the 19th century. And then pretty soon Cyrus Scofield of the Scofield Bible in the 20th century found it and included it in the notes of his Bible. And then the Dallas Theological Seminary picked up on it, and now America believed the futurist approach to Bible interpretation that was unheard of until Ribera in 1590 came up with the idea. By the way, a Jesuit priest. They were all Jesuit priests. And the whole purpose was to find a theology that people would swallow that would get the Pope out of trouble. The historicist interpretation of the Bible. Historicism, a method of interpreting the Bible prophecies, associated symbols with a historical person, nation, or event. It can result in a view of progression and continuous fulfillment of prophecy covering the period from biblical time to the second coming. The vast majority of Protestant reformers from the Reformation into the 19th century held the historicist view. In fact, I think later on I go on to tell you it was the view of Jesus, it was the view of the disciples, it was the view of the early church fathers, historicists. That prophecy is continual from the time of Daniel all the way through to the second coming without any interruptions. That's what they all believed. That's what they all taught until Ribera wrote a book. And Lacunza read it. And then Irving thought it was great. And then Darby picked up on it. And Scofield put it in his Bible. And now all the United States believes the futurist view of Bible interpretation. The futurist view is a Christian eschatological view that interprets portions of the books of Daniel and Revelation as future events in a literal, physical, apocalyptic, and global context. I wish I could go deeper in this. Listen, I'm trying to stay on the surface so that you will understand. The point here is we're in the age of deception. And now I'm going to give you 5 points. I'm almost done. I'm going to give you 5 points. And in these 5 points, you'll clearly see that prior to Ribera's book that he wrote, in order, the Council of Trent said, we got to do something to stop this bleeding. Our people are leaving. They don't believe it. And all because we can't answer the argument of the Protestant interpreters. And now all of America believes in the futurist view of the Bible. I mean, this is incredible, folks. But let me say something to you as we move on now to close this. What did the Jews do with Jesus? They rejected him. Why? Because for years before Jesus showed up, Satan had introduced deceptions to the leaders who taught the people so that when Jesus came, they did not recognize him as the Messiah and they crucified him. How many years did Jesus minister? 3.5. How many people were in the upper room? 120. 120, folks. Deception is powerful. I don't want you to sit there and say, oh, well, the pastor said futurism isn't true, so I'm okay. No. No. Because the next thing you're going to see is the futurists performing miracles, including raising people from the dead. You better be ready for this. So here are the 5 points. They rejected Jesus. By the way, I want to tell you this. I wondered if I would have rejected Jesus if I was a Jew back then. I wonder if I would have said, oh no, that's not what the Bible says. Or I would say, well, the religious leaders are saying that and I trust them. That's a scary thing. Number one, futurism condemns the interpretation of the reformers. It condemns the views of all these men and all the martyrs and all the confessors and the faithful witnesses of Christ for long centuries. Number one. Oh boy, technology. Number two. Futurism passes by the greatest power governing the largest number of people for the longest period of time. Did you get that? See, if everything's in the future, then that means that after Nero, by the way, I'm giving you, Nero was the Antichrist. And after Nero, it all skips to a future time, which is now what, after Nero, almost 2,000 years? Or 2,000 years? Wait a minute, what about the 18... centuries in between. Oh, the Bible didn't say anything about that. Didn't say anything about the gigantic religious system that governed the largest number of people for the longest period of time. Number three, futurism ignores that neither Jesus, the disciples, nor the church fathers held the futurist gap theory view, the theory that the book of Revelation ever overleaps nearly 18 centuries of Christian history, plunging at once into the distant future, devoting its entirely to one individual in the last 3.5 years of Earth's history. See, I know I wish I could explain how they get all this 3.5 year in one individual. Ribera had a partner, a Jesuit partner, called Cardinal Bellarmine. And Cardinal Bellarmine came up with the idea that that future Antichrist, the Antichrist isn't here yet. It's in the future. And that's a Jewish person of the tribe of Dan. And that's what the little horn of Daniel 7 is talking about, this future guy. And that's what Revelation 13, the sea beast coming out of the sea, is talking about, jumping over 18 centuries. Whoa. Number four. Futurism ignores that. Didn't I just read that? Okay, I'll let you jump down to the real number four, please stand up. Futurism denies that nearly all of the writers of the first 15 centuries of Christian era believed that the apocalypse was a comprehensive prophecy reaching from the date of its publication about 100 AD when John wrote it, to the end of all things. Number five. Get this, folks. Here we go. Futurism teaches that the prophetic visions of Revelation from chapter 4 to 19 prefigure events still wholly future and not to take place till the last 3.5 years of Earth's history. Now let's look at it. Let's repeat that in a more meaningful way. Number six. Futurism devised, and in fact that's supposed to be Satan, devised futurism as a system of prophetic interpretation which would blind the people's eyes to the last great message now going forward to the world. What message is that? Come on, what is it? Three angels' messages? What chapter are they found in? Chapter 14. Oh, but that's in the future. And now all of Protestant America believes it, folks. Okay, I don't deny that in these Protestant churches in America there are individuals who don't believe it, but they're in churches that don't teach historicism, they teach futurism. So when Jesus comes a second time, they're not going to be any more ready than the Jews were when Jesus came the first time. Where do we sit? So here it is. In 4 weeks, we're going to have an evangelistic meeting here. The young people are going to be putting it on. Thomas, is Dina here? No, Dina's not here. A young girl who's here with Youth Rush is going to preach it in Spanish while our own Joseph Cadiz is preaching in English, but in two separate rooms, folks. Why? Why? Didn't we just have one a couple months ago? And before that, didn't we have one? Why are we doing this? I'm tired of coming. Because the rest of the world is deceived. We're the only ones that can tell them, basically. I know I'm using hyperbole now. Okay, I want to be careful. There are good people in all the other churches. But the truth is, they need to understand that they believe a lie and they're going to miss the Holy Man, like the Holy Land, just like the 30,000 kids that ended up in slavery. And we have to do it. We have to do it. Out of the love for our fellow man, even people that may have hurt us. We've got to do it. Because we're living in an age of deception. And this is serious business. And you can bet the understanding of Armageddon, you will discover, is all wrong because it's based on futurism. So we got to look at it to do it right. So here we go, folks. I want to show you a picture. See that picture? How does that look on the big screen? You see that blob? That's a blob. And that's a closer blob. Ooh, we're getting closer. Ah. You know what that is? Somebody stepped on a strawberry on the ground outside the door of our food room, and those thingies there are billions of ants. All the ants came. By the way, there were a couple laying on the ground and there were no ants or few ants on them. But the one that was squished, man, it was covered. This was yesterday, by the way. Folks, we need to squish the fruit so that the people come to eat. Because they're being deceived. And we are the ones that can help them to understand this. And if we don't do what we're doing here, including Youth Rush being here every year, because we believe in what they're doing is God sent, and this church must do it. And so, in this age of deception, as we look at the series on Armageddon, folks, I pray you stick with us. Be patient. But we've got to bring this message in any way, shape, or form we can, so that they can have a chance to know the truth, just the way God afforded you the privilege of either being born in this church or brought into this church like I was as a convert. If they didn't do those meetings in Superior, Wisconsin, I do not know where I would be today. Father, as we ponder these thoughts of the age of deception, I pray that you would help us not condemn the people that we just talked about, Lord, but instead realize that our job is to share the truth. And I pray, Lord, that you make this a center of evangelism, not to the point where everyone gets exhausted, but to the point where we do everything we can to reach as many as possible, because your coming is so soon. How do I know? I'll add to the list. If they rejected you, Jesus, because they were deceived, then why is Satan working so hard to deceive people today, except he knows you're coming? Help us to be ready and to cooperate with you. In Jesus' name, amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and contingent financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry, as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.